This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. In case you're wondering, this is part two of a two-part series where we're interviewing Dr. Brian Smith from the ASU School of Life Sciences. Dr. Smith is what we call a bee movie maker. He's been doing research on bees and learning how they navigate the world about them and how they communicate and how he actually is talking to the bees, so to speak. In the previous show, we got to learn about bees in general, got to take a tour inside a beehive. In this show, we get to do some other things where we will go back to the beehive and listen to a performance. It's actually a performance piece by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, and we've been having people guess what that's going to be. We also get to learn about an extreme sport that Dr. Smith is involved with. He's been doing it from quite a young age. Now let's pick up with a question from our last program. How long have you been a bee movie maker?
Well, probably, believe it or not, over 20 years. I started out long ago with an interest in bees, and I've progressively become more and more interested in them because, as I told you, sometimes the behaviors are very fascinating. And one of the things that fascinates me most is for any bee to do its job, it has to be able to learn. So a honeybee can learn. They're not as sophisticated as we are about it, but honeybees can learn a lot of things. They don't come into the world knowing which flowers are out there and which flowers are going to be important. So a forager bee goes out every day knowing that it has to learn where the good flowers are and come back and communicate it. The next day, it may be different flowers in a different place. So the bee has to realize that what it learned yesterday isn't any good anymore, so I have to learn something new.
So bees can learn, which is one of the questions I was going to ask, and you've done a good job of answering it. They're not pre-programmed. It's not like they come out and they're going to do one thing only. They can have many jobs, and they have to learn on a daily basis.
That's right.
It's pretty impressive, especially when we're talking about something that has about how many neurons in its brain?
About 1 million.
About 1 million. And how many do we have in our brain?
About 5 billion neurons.
About 5 billion. Well, I know that you and I have talked about this before. So if we take collectively a typical bee colony, we have the equivalent of a human brain, right?
The same number of neurons.
Approximately
the same number of neurons. Now, remember, they're connected differently. All of the neurons in our brains, and we have somewhere around 5 billion neurons in our brains, and they're all interconnected in some way, and they communicate directly with each other. In honeybees, those neurons are in different bees. Their collective colony brain is connected a little differently from ours.
Right.
So the collective colony brain can send one part of its brain, one bee, off some distance to the north to look for something. And at the same time, it can send another part of its brain, another bee, off some distance to the south to look for something. Of course, we can't do that.
No, it's the ultimate distributive computing, I would have to say, that where
in
you can
start. In some sense, that's exactly right. The bees are integrating, to use a word, collecting a lot of information around their environment because they can send, think of it this way, little bits of their brains off in many different directions at once. But a honeybee brain has about 1 million neurons. 1 million neurons is still a lot. And the bees are very impressive when you sit down and try to train them. It's fun to do because you realize when you have a bee in front of you and you're training it and you're watching it, it's not responding to something at first, and then afterwards it starts responding to it as a result of me giving them an odor associated with a little droplet of sucrose, which they want. And then afterwards, when you give them the odor, they start responding to the sucrose. And then the fun thing for me is I realize I've just been communicating with the bee.
Right. And we've been talking about this idea of senses and how we interact with the environment, which is the theme of this show. So your research really deals with that on a very fundamental level.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way a bee's brain works, especially for the sense of smell, is very similar to the way our own brains work. So what I like to do is say, well, I'm using honeybees as a way of not just understanding how their brains work, but also in a more fundamental sense, this is how all brains work, or maybe how all brains work. So we're testing these ideas. You know, what can we find out about brains in general from the way honeybee brains work?
When you talk about stimulating the bee, I think about what Pavlov and his dog, you know, the Pavlovian response where you have the dog and the bell and you ring the bell and it salivates because it's associated with getting food. So do you have Pavlovian bees? Is that what you're doing?
That's exactly what we do. It's Pavlovian conditioning. Whereas Pavlov gave the bell and fed the dogs a little bit of meat powder or a dog biscuit, after a few times we give them the bell and the dog starts to salivate as though it anticipates that food is about to come. And that's exactly what we do with bees. It's the same kind of behavioral conditioning. I think about it as a way of asking the bees a question.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I want to know, Dr. Biology, can you smell something? I can simply give it to you and ask you, and you can tell me. The bees and I don't have a common language, so they can't tell me directly. But if I give them an odor, and I follow it with sucrose, and afterwards they change their response to the odor, because they start to get ready for the sucrose, and I can see that, well, they just told me something. They told me that they can detect the odor. If I give them one odor, followed by sucrose, but sometimes I give them a different odor, followed by nothing, and they respond to the first odor, but not to the other one that's not followed by anything, the unrewarded odor, they've just told me they can discriminate between the two odors. They can tell the two odors apart.
Right.
So it's a very, very simple, straightforward way of, as I say, asking the bees a question.
So the bee movies, and by the way, we're going to have some of your movies up on the Ask a Biologist site. It'll be under your profile. I think the title is Bee Movie Maker. Mm-hmm. That'll go along with this podcast, so people can actually come to the website and look at these movies. I want to remind people that no bees were harmed in the making of these movies, although it looks somewhat uncomfortable because you need to restrain them. One colleague of yours mentioned we restrain our children in the backseat of the car with a car seat to protect them. This is probably no worse than that. So they might be a little uncomfortable or a little unhappy, but we're not doing anything to them.
We have to restrain them because we need to keep them on the video frame so we can see what they're doing. And we need to know that they're going to be there when we need them to be there to stimulate them.
Well, Brian, before I ask the three questions every guest that comes on the show is asked, I thought we'd return to the beehive and listen in. Along with it, we're going to hear a piece by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov called Flight of the Bumblebee. We talked a little bit about this at the beginning of the show, and we were going to have you guess what we might be playing. This piano version is being performed by Margarita Denenberg. It's fun to listen to that piece, especially after we've had a chance to visit the inside of a honeybee hive earlier. I can imagine the hub of activity in there is probably rather exciting even, where bees are, well, especially the worker bees, are busy as a bee, doing the things that they have to do to keep the colony going. So along those lines of activity and excitement, do you remember the first time you wanted to be a scientist or were thinking of becoming a biologist? Do you remember that moment, or was there actually a moment that happened?
Well, I can remember way back when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, well before cable television, and there were only 2 or 3 channels, and every once in a while, one of the channels would transmit a program about a marine biologist by the name of Jacques Cousteau.
Oh, yes.
And I remember it looked so adventurous to go off on a ship on the ocean and do research on animals and watch them behave. It was just such an exotic thing that it immediately instilled in me an interest in watching animals behave and traveling. I am always trying to find ways to go off, and when I have time, to go off to exotic places, and spent a lot of time in the tropics watching animals behave and do these sorts of things. I'm not sure I really understood what it meant to be a scientist at that age, but those programs in particular really were very influential for me. When I was probably only 6 or 7 or 8 years old, I would just be glued to the television, and nothing else was allowed to happen that involved me and our family whenever a Jacques Cousteau special came on, because you know it's going to come on, and unlike today where it's on 14 times a week, it's on once, so you have to be there for it.
Right. I have to say that we have a lot of questions that come in to Ask a Biologist around marine biology. I think the call of the sea, that adventure, definitely is powerful for students. And I bet you're right that Jacques Cousteau and his programs are responsible for many of the biologists and scientists we have today.
Well, it turns out my wife used to work for Jacques Cousteau.
No kidding. She worked for Jacques Cousteau? I have to say I'm jealous.
Yeah, it was very interesting. When she lived in Los Angeles, she worked for Jacques Cousteau and some of his family at some point. So I loved Jacques Cousteau, and I wound up marrying a woman who at one point in her life worked for Jacques Cousteau. So
did you get to meet him?
No, I never got to meet him.
Oh, that's too bad.
Unfortunately, I would have loved to have done that.
It's too bad that we won't ever be able to have him on the Ask a Biologist program, because I think he would have been a great guest.
No, he died several years ago, but I think his impact is long-lasting, and I think of him, and I put him in league with some of the other great communicators of science, Carl Sagan, for example, the astronomer. There are many essays by Carl Sagan who, and I would recommend a lot of students read things that he wrote, because he's just a wonderful communicator, and he too has had an influence on my thinking of science.
Communicator, inventor, and adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we'd like to do in our wildest dreams, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Now that we know what probably got you started in a career in biology and a life in science, I'm going to take that all away from you. What would you be if you couldn't do any science or be a biologist?
Whatever I would be would have to let me travel. And I love reading books about travel. For example, I'm a big fan of an author. His name is Paul Thoreau. I've read many of his books. One of my favorites is called The Pillars of Hercules, where he did something that most people would think is odd. He went to the Rock of Gibraltar in Spain, and from the Rock of Gibraltar, what you can see is a similar structure in Morocco on the other side of the Mediterranean. It's close enough. And those are called the Gates of the Mediterranean, the Pillars of Hercules. And you sail through them to get from the Atlantic into the Mediterranean. So he made a vow to get from the Rock of Gibraltar to the rock in Morocco by land.
Oh.
So he car, rail, boat, whatever he had to do to go all around the Mediterranean, and he wrote about the things he encountered. So for him, I have the impression, and for me, travel is not necessarily about being somewhere, it's about the adventure of getting somewhere.
Exactly, exactly.
So in the best of all possible worlds, and maybe I'll still do this someday, is I would do something like that.
Now, you also have a pretty interesting, if not rather exciting, sport that you partake in. You skydive.
Yes.
How long have you been skydiving?
Since I was 16. I've been flying planes since I was 13, although I no longer fly planes. I don't have the time to do it, but I still skydive.
How many jumps?
I'm about to hit 2,000.
I don't like the word hit and skydive at the same time.
Well, yes, of course. It's a metaphor. I'm about to achieve 2,000 skydives.
Well, for a brief time when you're skydiving, you get to sort of fly around, and you have nothing mechanical, and therefore you kind of get bee's perspective, only for a short period.
Well, you're not flying like a bee flies. The best way to describe it to people is if you're driving down the road at 60 mile an hour and you stick your hand out the window and hold your hand flat against the wind, you can feel a lot of pressure from the wind. Well, when you jump out of an airplane, you start falling at 120 miles an hour and it's hitting your whole body. And you have a lot of pressure. So your body has to be symmetrical. If you're not symmetrical, you'll start to turn, or you'll start to move forward, or you'll start to move backwards, because your body deflects air just like your hand will deflect air if you angle it a little bit. Everybody sort of played that game.
Right, outside the car window.
I don't mean jumping out of an airplane. I meant outside the car window. So an interesting thing is that you can literally move very fast and very, very precisely when you're falling through the air at 120 mile an hour if you know how to use your body to control the air. So one of the other things that I do regularly is yoga.
Mm-hmm.
I like doing yoga because it keeps me very flexible, very healthy. It's good for my mind. But also it's good for understanding how to move my body. And when you have 120 mile an hour of air hitting it, you realize how important that can be. If I have a student who's skydiving, and many times students are very nervous, obviously, and they are stiff as a board. They're very tense. And if you take a board and throw it off of a building and watch what happens, it flips all over the place because it can't deflect the air. It can't control the air. A good experiment is take a piece of paper, 8.5 by 11, hold it over your head and drop it. And the paper will flip over several times and float back and forth as it hits the ground. And that's what you would do if you're stiff as a board when you're skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take that paper and just take your fist in the middle of the paper and punch down, so it's not a hole, but the paper is sort of bowed. You make a cup with it. It's coming up at the ends and it's really symmetrical. Now hold that paper above your head and drop it. It'll go straight down.
Oh.
Because it can deflect the air uniformly around it. And that's what will happen if you do something that seems counterintuitive, but if you relax. If you relax when you're skydiving, the air pushes your body into that natural symmetrical position, and you fall straight down in a very controlled way.
Fabulous. Well, I have not done any skydiving.
Well, you should.
I know. I think about it, but that might be as far as I go. Before I let you go, I have one more question. What advice do you have for someone that's wanting to get into the world of science? It could be a young scientist, and it could be people that maybe like bees, they've decided to switch or shift their jobs, and they want to go on to a different career.
I say find something you like doing, which means trying a lot of different things, because you may not know at this point what you like best. So experiment. Work a little bit in different kinds of things. And when you find something you like doing, don't take no for an answer, but be really persistent.
Wonderful advice. Well, Dr. Smith, thank you for visiting with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist. My guest has been Professor Brian Smith from the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. The piano version of Flight of the Bumblebee was performed by Margarita Denenberg, who is a student in the Herberger College of the Arts, also at ASU. As we mentioned earlier, that piece was originally composed by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, but the piece that you heard was transcribed by Sergei Rachmaninoff for the piano. The Ask a Biologist program is produced on the campus of Arizona State University, and even though you can't send us your questions while we're on the air because we don't broadcast live, you can always send us questions with our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu, or you could just Google the words Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.